Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Why does making friends as an adult feel so
what
hard?
What should I wear on a first
what
date?
What the hell is a formal
but that
why
hookup
is
was not
first
good?
Home
what
so
do I want my life to look like in 5 years?
We want to know too.
Since 2012, the Every Girl has been an online destination to help women around the world achieve the life of their dreams. Now, we're excited to bring you the same inspiring content with the Every Girl podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of the Every Girl podcast. I am here with our editorial and podcast assistant, Emma.
Hello, welcome back.
Wait, you know what we haven't talked about that I just thought of? Are we ready to share our thoughts on Cowboy Carter? Has it ruminated enough?
Yes.
I just want to know, like, your top.
My first few listens, my favorite was Daughter. It sort of feels like the sister to Kill Bill by SZA. It's like a dark, moody revenge song. So that was my favorite initially. Now I think my favorite is Bodyguard because it's like the catchiest and I find myself humming it and it has the like, you know,
that was really good. You should
Thank
be on
you.
The album.
Thank you. What about you? What are your favorites?
Okay, love Bodyguard. I haven't heard anyone talk about this one and I don't know why it's not getting more hype. Levi's Jeans.
Great.
It's so good.
So good.
It just makes you feel so good. Like, I want to go to the beach, and I never want to go to the beach. And it's not even beachy. It just, like, makes you want to be like, ugh, it's summer. I'm young. I'm hot. We're experiencing life.
So true. Post Malone was an unexpected. Like, when I saw him on the track list, I was like, okay.
Also,
like,
him singing. He comes in with this, like, beautiful melody. For a moment, I'm like, is that Beyonce? And then it's like, nope, it's Post Malone. Surprise. The real twist. Levi Jeans is my favorite, but I'm very close with, I know this is everyone's, but Two Most Wanted. The first time I listened to it, I was like, oh my God, yeah, this is so good. Every time I listen to it since, I'm like, no, this is the best song ever. It develops every time I listen to it, and there are so many layers to it.
Every time I hear their voices together, chills.
The part of the song where you think the buildup is, I'll be your shotgun ride. Like, you think that's going to be, like, the belt part. But then it goes, I'll be your backseat, baby. And it's just layers and layers.
Yes.
It's just so good. So that's my second favorite. Overall, work of art. A masterpiece.
I love that every celebrity is just like, yeah, I'm floored. Every red carpet interview you see these days is like, what'd you think of Cowboy Carter? And everyone's like, what do you mean? It's amazing.
Don't ask the stupid question. All right. Shall we go into Ask the Every Girl this week?
Hard pivot, but we did need to follow up.
We can't promise that we're going to give our thoughts and then not. We are ladies of our word.
Exactly. And we needed to let it marinate.
Tell me what the question of this week is.
The Ask the Every Girl this week is, I set a goal to prioritize my friendships so I can feel like I have deeper connections. Any tips?
I mean, this is like your question because you are in your friendship era right now. So I know you're going to have so many good tips. But first of all, I love that this is an intention. Like we talk about with this year being like the year of girlhood. Let's make friendship our number one priority instead of what it usually has been, which is like, oh, yeah, friends are just like there. Or like friends are what you have time for when you don't have time with your significant other or your career or whatever. Friends have typically been a lower priority. And I love that we're like, no, friends is the number one intention. So
yeah,
I love this question. When we had Danielle Bayer Jackson on, the friendship expert, so many of her tips changed the way that I view friendships and treat friendships. I think all the time about her sharing those statistics about how it takes like 60 hours to go from an acquaintance to a friend. And then it takes like 200 hours to become a really close best friend. Mm-hmm. So I think when you look at that, it really does simplify and make it feel less scary to form these very deep friendships because it is just an investment of time. I also think that doesn't necessarily have to mean, you know, you're hanging out with them every night of the week. Fit them into your life. Call a friend on your ride home from work. Invite them to a workout class or to go for a walk with you. I know you've given this tip before. If you work from home, go work with them at a coffee shop. Exist around each other. I think that even just that time spent together is really deepening the bond because it's just about spending more and more time.
I think about our episode with Danielle every day because I feel like her tips that she gave were so helpful in terms of, the amount of time it takes to really build a long-term connection. I feel like that's something you can also really use to forgive yourself if you're like, I really want to bring all of my friendships to the next level, but it's taking so long. It's like, yeah, of course it's taking so long.
For you, it's really been your number one priority, which I love. So what have you discovered works with both turning those acquaintances into really deep friendships and then also just like deepening friendships overall? What have you found to be helpful?
The first thing I've learned is that when you are trying to make friendships a priority in your life, it means budgeting your energy towards friendship, which is extremely challenging to do in our society that makes it so easy for you to prioritize career or romantic relationship. It's like, no, actually, there's the secret third thing that you have to really effortfully budget your energy towards.
You know that I love a budget. That's what I'm saying. I don't love a budget.
I was going to say, you knew?
This is news to me. What I was trying to say is, you know, I love an energy conversation. Yes. And I love that you use the word budget.
Yeah.
Because I think that's such a great way to explain it. We don't have this like limitless amount of energy. We have a certain amount of energy that we have to look at and say, what is worth my energy? If your intention and your priority is to find and deepen and make friendships, you have to allow your energy to reflect that. Your energy cannot be spent on your kids, your household, your work, your relationship. If your intention is to deepen friendships, you have to save and reserve and strategize about how to have enough energy.
Right. And like Danielle highlighted in her episode, sometimes those things can overlap. If you are a mom and you have mom friends, then obviously budgeting your energy towards your kids and your mom friends is going to overlap. Or if you work from home and you're working from home with a friend, that's career and friendship energy overlapping. I think you still have to be really conscious that you're budgeting energy towards friendship as well, because it's so easy to just not. Something else I have learned about deepening friendships specifically is to focus on quality over quantity. I actually have an article I wrote about this on The Every Girl about quantity over quality friendships.
What's the title of the article?
Don't Have a Big Group of Girlfriends, Here's Why It Doesn't Matter. And it was inspired by several years ago, I went through an experience when I just lost a big friend group kind of all at once. And I was like, maybe this is a sign for me to focus on quality and deepening, like this person asked. And I ended up feeling hugely more rewarded and supported.
I love that point because I think we all are expecting we need to have this like girlfriend group. When I moved to LA and I started forming these different friendships, what I did feel like I was missing was that I like missed having that friend group. Like I love my friend group from college where we're all in a group chat. We all check in with each other. We all plan trips. It's so fun to have that group. But it is interesting because like other friend groups, it does bring these other elements where it's so impossible for everybody to feel equally close with everybody else. So then you might end up spending a lot of time with people that you maybe don't click with just because they're around the same people. Whereas if you focus on individual friendships instead of looking for this group, then each friend you have is a deep connection and you're spending one-on-one time and you're feeling like they're actually a worthwhile friend for you to have instead of feeling like, okay, I'm in this friend group. I'm really close to some people, other people that I spend my time with, not so much. I think that that's really interesting to focus more on the individual friendships and building up that quality instead of feeling like I only have two friends, so something must be wrong with me.
And I think groups have their place. You definitely deserve to feel like you're in community. But I do think it's not always the thing that's going to make you feel the most fulfilled and supported in your friendships. Often it's going to be like sitting down with one person and having a 4-hour super deep conversation.
And if you look at like Sex and the City is the most famous friend group of all time, but it shows their individual friendship so much. Yes, they have the lunches where they're all hanging out, but you see instances where all four of them have their own dynamics individually with each one of each other. Does that grammar make sense? You know what I mean? If you're in a group, I think that that's just an important thing to be aware of is like, how am I fostering this individual relationship and connection with each one? Because that is what deepens connection. Going back to this end goal, I want to have deeper friendships. That's the key, is having this individual quality time. And that doesn't always have to mean let's go have the 4-hour dinner together, which is ideal. But it also might mean we're all hanging out. This person I haven't really caught up with in a while, I want to spend some like one-on-one time and make sure to catch up with them individually.
Yeah. If you are trying to get really deep with someone who you might be like a surface level friend with, I have always found that either asking what they were like in high school or the craziest story from their high school experience will always set off a long conversation about the like politics of their high school and how it relates to their family dynamics and then how that propelled them into their lives and futures. That's my go-to question if I'm trying to know someone a lot better.
That's a really great tip because, yeah, high school, it feels easy to talk about. It's not like, tell me your deepest, darkest secret or what do you go to your therapist about? It's so easy, but it's such a deep, vulnerable experience. So that's a really great tip. I say this all the time, but for deepening any connection, whether it's you want to be closer to your mom, whether it's you want your acquaintances to go to more closer friendships, whether it's with your coworkers, no matter what connection it is that you want to deepen, I think the most important way to do that is to care more about what other people have to say more than caring about what you have to say. When you listen and really want to hear what other people have to say, you're automatically connecting so much deeper. I think the other person will feel closer to you when they feel like they're being heard and listened to. So instead of being so in your head, how do I come off sounding funny? How do I sound interesting? How do I come across, as we so often are focused on when we're trying to impress someone and make them a new friend or to deepen the connection? The secret is to think about like, wow, I really want to get to know them. I really want to hear what they have to say. Oh, they're telling me about their high school experience. Instead of thinking about, wow, I can't wait until I can share about my high school experience, start really thinking about like, wow, what was that like for them? I really want to understand. I want to listen. I think that that is the easiest hack to deepen any connection.
That's such a good point.
I feel like these are all really helpful things for when you are building deeper connections. Another little caveat of this question is like, keeping those relationships that are maybe like those long distance friends that you love so much and you want to stay close to, but it is really hard to feel that same level of connected. You are recently out of college. I know you are living far apart from some of your friends. Is there anything that you've been doing that has kept you feeling connected and close to those long distance friends?
You know, I think I could be a lot better at long distance friendship, to be honest, because I can be fairly unresponsive. I tend to sometimes just drop off the face of the earth, and I would like to not. So I am available for tips on how to maintain long distance friendships in a healthier way, aside from just like sending funny tweets in the group chat.
I have a hot take on this. Yeah. I feel very much the same as you. I don't want to be on my phone any more than I have to. Maybe that's like an occupational hazard of just what we do. We do have to be on our phone more than
internet
other
people
industries. So maybe that's just more of like an us problem. But I barely even call my mom because I hate being on my phone. Literally. I hate texting. I hate FaceTiming. And I don't mean like once I'm FaceTiming with someone, I'll obviously like love and have fun talking to them. But it's just the act of being on my phone any more than I have to feels really draining to me. I feel like the best friendships are the ones that are like, oh my God, I just thought of this hilarious thing, or like, whoa, Beyonce released a new album. And then when you come together, it feels like nothing is different. And then you get to catch up on each other's lives and share those things with each other. I just feel like it doesn't always have to be this, like, I have to know everything that's going on in your life and I have to be caught up and we have to talk all the time. I kind of feel like, to me, the in-person connection will always trump the texts and the calls and the FaceTimes. I feel like as friends, we can all work to be a little more low maintenance. I have had friends that have gotten mad at me because I haven't been texting them as much.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, that made me feel bad. Like for a long time, I was like, ugh, I have to be better. I'm such a bad friend. And then I got to a certain point where I was like, but I know that when we're together, I am the most present person. I know that I care so much about their lives. I know that I'm such a good friend to them. I know that I'm there if they need me. I need to stop feeling bad about not responding, not texting, not calling more, and just be okay knowing this is the kind of friendship that serves me and that I feel good in, where we don't have to talk all the time and we can come together and feel like nothing has changed. And that it just doesn't feel high maintenance. It doesn't feel like we have to be maintaining it all the time. It just feels natural.
I completely agree.
But I will say, here's a hack for you. I'm trying to think of like good tips that has worked for me.
Okay.
Now that I have given my TED talk on like why friendship should be low maintenance. I'm about to give like a very high maintenance tip. But something that I have been doing lately that I actually think has been really helpful. So I... admittedly, same as you, I'm not good at keeping up with long distance friends, remembering birthdays. That was something I realized I'm not good at. So I found this company called Moonpig. It is thousands of like very, very cute cards that you go through online. There's like pop culture-y ones. So I add all of my friends' birthdays, their kids' birthdays, like anniversaries, whatever. And then I get reminders from Moonpig so I don't forget, which that's been huge because I cannot keep everything straight.
I like need to do that.
It's the same price of a card from a drugstore, which is crazy. So it's even more affordable. So I just order my friends these like very adorable personalized cards. I also like sending those just because cards, like if a friend had a tough week, or I recently found a really cute Beyonce card and sent it to one of my friends because Beyonce's our thing. So it feels easier for me than keeping up with text message. And it's just a nice little way to be like, here's something that you probably are not getting from other people. Like no one else is sending individual cards, but I want you to know I'm thinking about you. To me, that's been a really good hack for keeping up with those long distance friendships.
And I love that you get notifications, because anytime I remember someone's birthday, the only reason I remember is because of Facebook. I'm like instantly depressed. And so
like, I have failed as a friend.
Yes, it's almost an act of self-care for you as well.
The bottom line, there's no one right way to be a good friend or to deepen friendships. It's just about finding the ways to make people that we love feel cared for and let them know that we're thinking of them without it feeling like a huge drain on us. I think that's also going back to like the energy budgeting that we talked about. Like, yes, you have to be aware of how to budget energy for friendships, but at the same time, you should be aware of where friendships may be draining your energy.
Wow. I feel like we just piled so much info on this person, but hopefully they came away with some tangible tips.
In the end, there is no better relationship, in my opinion, than women friendships. It is just the best. So I think we should prioritize it. Let's dive into today's conversation. We are talking with Amanda Montell, who is the author of Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language, and her latest book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality, which is about cognitive biases that are impacting us in the information age. Emma, this episode is so Emma-coded. I was obsessed with her book, but you really are a big Amanda fan.
I geeked out over this episode. I cried during the recording. The word I would use to describe it was healing, which everyone else is going to be like, you're such a nerd, but I love it. So get excited.
According to Amanda, we are in the era of overthinking, and there are psychological and evolutionary reasons why you might be struggling or stressed or confused right now. If you've ever wondered why you stayed in that toxic relationship much longer than you should, or why your significant other is obsessed with Taylor Swift, or why social media makes you feel bad about your own life, we're getting into the psychological principles that are probably affecting you much more than you realize and what to do about them. This is one of the most honestly fascinating conversations I think we've had. Please welcome Amanda Montell to the Every Girl podcast. What kind of dog do you have?
He's a border collie lab mix. He's good boy, but he's a big boy. And then I have these two unbelievably demanding felines, and I live in like a tiny house. So I would have it no other way, rest assured, but like it makes existing difficult. Yeah.
I have literally one dog and I can't even handle him. I don't know how you do it with three animals.
Well, funny enough, the cats are the highest maintenance because the dog just like plays outside all day long. And so we forget he's there. And he's just like so happy-go-lucky. The cats, meanwhile, have so many quirks.
Are they like they want to hang out with you or are they like don't come near me?
No, they're obsessed with us, with me and my, I hate the word fiance, but we are engaged. My betrothed. No, they're incredibly codependent and needy and social. We did this to ourselves.
The craziness. It's all part of the beautiful life. Well, Amanda, welcome to the Every Girl podcast.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for having me. I am an Every Girl, aren't I?
You're the Every Girl.
Here I am in my pastel blue blazer, just like trying to exist.
Living life with two cats and a dog. Just the relatable gal.
My whole shtick is like, relatable nerd vibes, which I feel like is very Every Girl. I'm always home. I love a cozy moment. I feel very aligned with the Every Girl mission, dare yeah. I say.
You are on brand.
Thank you.
I want to go way back to your childhood.
Oh, whoa.
Would a young Amanda, your childhood Amanda, would they be surprised by what you do now, being an author, especially an author who writes about things like linguistics and cults?
Oh my gosh, what a beautiful question. I do write about the concept of nostalgia in my book, and I have an interesting relationship to nostalgia, my personal nostalgia of my own memories, because I had like a very happy upbringing, but I just hated being an adolescent, like being a teenager. The good parts about it were totally lost on me. I was like, I cannot wait to be an adult. But as I get older, you can't help but feel a little bit insecure as you age as a woman in this culture. So I sometimes have this revisionist history view of my adolescence where I'll be like, oh gosh, but there was hope then. Am I wrong? And do I actually really wish that I was 17 again or something like that? And then I'll watch some rom-com that came out during those years, and it will put me in that headspace of being 17 or 16. And I'll think like, no way. My adolescent self would be so pumped about who I am now, even if I'm getting older in the eyes of our youth-centric society and America values 20-somethings and such. I would so rather be in my 30s. And when I feel insecure about my career, or when I feel like I'm not achieving my goals, I actually really try to think about how my younger self would view my current self. And that helps a lot because I think she would be shook. She would be so pumped. I think it has always made a world of sense that I would go on to talk about social science and linguistics. I was a very verbose, dramatic child who wanted her life to be as meaningful as possible. So yeah, it tracks.
I think that's such a good tip. Like, it's so important to like look back at what younger us would think. We're so focused on, okay, what am I doing next? I still have yet to accomplish these things. And like, that's great. We have goals. But when we look back and be like, oh my God, my 16-year-old self would be fucking pumped at the life that I have now.
Oh my God.
We can't really feel grateful for the life that we have if we're not coming from that lens of seeing it from our 16-year-old self.
Absolutely. I have only continued to become interested in nostalgia as a coping mechanism, as a tool for generating hope when the present feels arduous. It can also be weaponized for sure, which we see in election years and things like that. But I actually think that nostalgia, yes, has been an incredibly useful tool for me in helping me appreciate the present, as counterintuitive as that may sound.
No, I think that totally makes sense because it's almost like you got to watch it happening. Let me watch from this different perspective, watch my life. And how does that change the way you see it?
Yeah, I love framing it that way. It's a way for your past self to be able to watch your present self, which I think is so magical.
So I want to dive into your new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking. So good. I could not put it down. it dives into exploring cognitive biases in our modern lives, and such a fascinating concept. What got you interested in cognitive bias? Why this topic?
So cognitive biases are these deep-rooted mental magic tricks that we play on ourselves. They're these psychological shortcuts that we've always taken since the early days of the human species in order to make sense of the world enough to survive it. Human beings have limited time, limited memory storage, limited cognitive resources. We need to be able to make decisions efficiently, and cognitive biases, low-key, without our knowledge, help us do this. Some of the most famous are confirmation bias and the sunk cost fallacy. Those may ring a bell, but there are hundreds of others. And in this book, I basically chose my 11 faves, the 11 that I felt were most relevant to the broader culture, but also my own life, could like really shed light on some of the irrational behaviors I myself have made over the years to my chagrin. And so some of those have these really interesting titles, including the halo effect, which describes our penchant to think that just because we like one quality in a person, that they must be perfect overall. And this is the cognitive bias that can explain so many of the extreme cycles of celebrity worship and dethronement that we see in society now. There's also a really interesting cognitive bias in the book called the IKEA effect, which describes our propensity to believe that an object is so much more valuable just because we participated in its creation. So that can explain why brands that capitalize on customer co-creation are so valuable. But it also explains why building an IKEA dresser makes you feel like you've truly accomplished something meaningful in the world. And there are deeper implications for that IKEA effect bias as well. So I came to become interested in this behavioral economics subject matter while researching my last book, Cultish, which is about the language of cults from Scientology to SoulCycle. My background's in linguistics, sociolinguistics specifically. I am so interested in the relationship between language, culture, and power. And my dad grew up in a cult, so writing about these various cult-ish groups along the influence continuum, so to speak, felt like a very natural book for me to write. But as I was researching cult influence for that book, I kept coming across all this really fascinating psychology research about cognitive biases, because as I was learning about what might motivate a person to join a cult and then stay in it for 20 years, so much longer than could possibly make sense to anyone else, cognitive biases like the sunk cost fallacy really played a role. But not only did these biases play a role in the behavior of these cult followers that I was studying, they also really resonated with my own life. I was like, okay, yeah, the sunk cost fallacy, this false perception that resources already spent on an endeavor, money, time, or even emotional resources like hope, well, that could explain why a person might stay in a cult for so many years. Like, oh my God, I've already put this much into it. You know, I can't give up now. It certainly could also explain why I chose to spend 7 of my formative years in a cult-like one-on-one romantic relationship, constantly justifying it to myself, saying, oh, it'll get better just around the corner. I really beat myself up for a long time after I got out of that relationship for my irrational decision to stay in it. But the sunk cost fallacy and related biases like loss aversion and additive solution bias explain so much of my behavior. That's an example of a much more personal application of these biases, but I also apply them to like broader, more zeitgeisty topics. But that's really how my fascination with this stuff came to be.
That's so interesting. I want to dive into a few examples with you so our audience like really understands this, because it's so fascinating how you apply it to life. It's cool to learn about these psychological concepts. But what was really cool for me about what you did in your book was you applied it to our lives, to modern day. So I have these different examples that I've pulled out, hard to narrow down, but I did. But before we dive into that, I really want our audience to understand how these cognitive biases, is that the plural?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I always feel fancy when I pronounce it that way. It's like, ooh, you know, like it's a foreign-derived suffix pronunciation.
It sounds so fancy. I feel like I need to make sure I pronounce it right so I don't sound stupid when I'm saying this.
It's like one parenthesis, two parentheses, one bias, two biases.
Oh, okay. Helpful tip. Now I won't forget it. So as you're explaining these cognitive biases, how is it impacting our mental health? Like, why is it important to know these cognitive biases are happening to us?
Yeah, great question. So I think I am not the only person who has this intuitive feeling of like, wow, why does it feel so painful and restless and confusing just to exist as a human being in the world right now? We're living in the so-called information age, but life only seems to be making less sense. We only seem to be in more conflict with each other. Discerning facts only seems to be getting more difficult, not less. How does that square? And as it turns out, cognitive biases are a huge part of the answer because, as I mentioned, these are these psychological shortcuts, many of which developed in early brains to help make sense of a simpler, less information overloaded world. But our brains have not caught up to the culture that we've created. Without our realizing it, we are applying these ancient tricks to problems that technology has created, these incredibly complicated problems having to do with being exposed to more information than we ever have in the past, more social identities than we ever have in the past. It's too much information for us to process, and cognitive biases are our best tool. They're the tool that our minds have always relied on, but they're sometimes not working for the modern problems that we have. And so there's this incredible clash between these innate mental magic tricks and the information age. We don't realize that because cognitive bias, that's not a household name. We don't even know how to pronounce it in the plurals. You know, I think we oftentimes blame ourselves and others for acting so irrationally, whereas there's actually something deep rooted in our minds at play here, becoming more aware of these biases and some of the tools that the psychologists that I spoke to for this book provided for how to combat them or make the best of them can really heal so much of that chaotic pain and confusion that so many of us are experiencing right now.
Such a great example of that was the example you mentioned about being in a toxic relationship. And I think the vast majority of people are in some kind of relationship that they look back and they're like, what was wrong with me that I chose that person that totally. I chose to stay? And there's so much shame and guilt associated with these decisions. And so I think that's a perfect example of identifying there was nothing wrong with you. You're not crazy. It was because of this cognitive bias. It's not your fault. I think it frees us from a lot of shame and guilt. I want to dive into that example a little bit more. So the sunk cost fallacy is the one that you're explaining, talking about how a toxic relationship is just a cult of one. Can you explain a little bit more about why you compare a toxic relationship to a cult? What is that sunk cost fallacy?
This was one of the most humbling realizations that I made when researching my last book, Cultish, because I went into that project a little bit smug. I feel like I go into a lot of my book projects feeling a little smug out of ignorance. I'm like, oh, I would never end up in a cult, or, oh, I can't be a susceptible to cognitive biases as that ding dong over there. And then at the end of these writing projects, I always feel humbled, brought back down to earth. And they also always end up leaving me more skeptical of myself and more compassionate toward other people, which I think is really useful and soothing, especially in these unprecedented times. So one of the most humbling realizations I made while researching Cultish was that the romantic relationship that I spent 7 years in my early 20s was very cult-like. The language that we use to describe cults versus one-on-one relationships is different. We might talk about grooming versus love bombing. We might talk about domestic theft versus financial exploitation. The terminology is a little bit different, but the techniques of influence are very much the same. And when our innate biases combine with those pressures, it can be really devastating, especially in the age of social media, which I argue is one of the judgiest eras of all time, when our sunk costs might include all of the Instagram posts that we posted of us with our partner looking so happy. I would really dig my heels in during the hardest times in my former relationship when things were going the worst. I subconsciously ended up posting the happiest photos of us online as a way to justify my choices to be in that relationship to myself and to any critics out there. And in this chapter, I found a really fascinating philosophy paper written by a guy who has a funny last name and people keep pointing it out. This philosophy expert named Ryan Duty. Okay.
Now Ryan Duty. What a poor guy.
Ryan Duty. So he published this fascinating paper that I found and incorporated into the chapter called The Sunk Cost Fallacy Might Not Be a Fallacy at All. And as you mentioned, it can be really shameful to admit that essentially you made a bad bet on yourself, that you are not even predictable to you. The sunk cost fallacy also applies to things like a poker hand. When you've put all this money in and you're looking at your hand and you're like, oh God, it's not good, but I've already put so much money in, I can't fold now. That is not as embarrassing because it's just luck of the draw. It's poker. But when the scenario is your own life and you've chosen your cards, you've chosen to join a cult or be involved with this person, then folding after you put so much on the table can be really embarrassing. It shows that you're a loose cannon, potentially, or that's what we think. And wanting to resist appearing like a loose cannon is a perfectly reasonable position to take because we're social creatures. We want to create the impression that we've always been predictable to ourselves, that we make good decisions, that we know what we want and always have, because that will attract other people. That will make others look like, okay, maybe this would be a good person to hire, or maybe this would be a good person to have as my friend. That doesn't mean that we should surrender to the sunk cost fallacy at every turn. Absolutely not. It is completely acceptable and natural. And I think that people who love you and would want you on their team in the game of life, so to speak, would, I mean, in my experience, they completely understand when you fold after sinking so much in. But that's the mental gymnastics at play. And it doesn't have to come with so much shame. So that's the sort of reckoning that I do in that chapter. And it was the most personal chapter in the book and definitely felt the most cathartic to write.
And then in that way, you're kind of freeing yourself because there is the shame involved with it that you're like, this is why this happened. Again, it's not on you. I also feel like this is such an interesting example of how obsessed with lasting success our culture is. Obviously, a toxic relationship is going to be different, but I think any relationship in general, people experience the sunk cost fallacy because they're like, I don't want it to look like I wasted all these years on this person and wasted this energy. Because again, it's like you said, that I made a mistake picking this person, when in reality, we can all grow. Like, that could have been a successful relationship for that time. Again, not including toxic relationships, but relationship in general. Like, for that time, that could have been a successful relationship. And then you grew and you changed and you want something else. I've seen this happen also with people who have moved across the country for a job. They're miserable at this job, but they're telling themselves, I have to make it work because I don't want to look like I made the mistake in making this move. When in reality, maybe the move was right for you for that time. Like, success does not have to mean it lasts our entire lives. It could have been good for that time. And then you can grow and change and move on.
Totally. And I think we apply a lot of like capitalistic success failure frameworks to this stuff. Life is not an endeavor of success and failure. You know, I have this habit of overly narrativizing my life. I don't know if anyone else listening has this problem, but I tend to treat my life as a story. And I talk about that in this chapter. And the thing about that's beautiful is that it's hashtag main character energy. I'm romanticizing my life, even the painful moments. However, life is not a well-plotted script or a well-plotted novel. Things happen at random sometimes, and that's okay. That also plays into the sunk cost fallacy, because when I make a decision, I'm like, I don't want this to feel like a random plot point. I have to justify why I incorporated this plot point into the story of my life. And that's not always a healthy lens. At the same time, there's a lot at play here, because when you go and realize like, okay, this is just the sunk cost fallacy, it's not really my fault, so to speak, then it can kind of inspire you to want to say like, well, everything happens for a reason, or apply those sort of new age cliches to what happened to you. And I don't think that's it either. I think it's okay to experience regret. I think it's okay to acknowledge that sometimes bad things happen at random. And again, your life is not a story. It's trial and error. It's an experiment. It's maybe like a piece of modern art. Like, not every brush stroke will make sense, but it's still like a piece of art or an experiment. And that's valid. And shame certainly doesn't help in the equation, no matter how you view it.
That's a really good point, that sometimes there isn't this like cosmic, there's a reason you did this and you grew so much. But sometimes there is just like the, I maybe made a move that wasn't the best move for me. And that's okay. Like, we're learning.
It happens.
Like, We don't need to feel the shame for it. We don't need to feel like, well, because I made this, it will be a mistake. Other people will judge me. So I have to stay in it. It's just, I tried it, didn't work out. And then I can try something else and move on.
Yeah. And as judgy as our society feels, especially with social media's limitless judgmental eyeballs, there's actually a lot of grace in our direct communities for pivoting or changing your mind.
Yeah, it's so true. I think that we expect, oh my gosh, if we leave this relationship that I've been telling everyone for years, I'm the happiest I've ever been. This is my person. I don't think anyone's waiting to be like, well, you told us 3 years ago that this was your person, like your
friend. Yeah.
We don't think about that about our friends. So no, they want to think that about you.
Actually, I even experienced the sunk cost fallacy. I've never thought of this before. I just thought of it right now. But I actually experienced the sunk cost fallacy when I got to college because I am embarrassed to admit, but I guess that's part of this whole conversation, that I spent my first semester of college as a theater major at NYU. Because I went to art school my whole upbringing and I really enjoyed doing theater. I was like pretty serious about it as I was growing up. And I always thought like, I'm going to be an actor in New York City. That's what I want to do for the rest of my life. And then basically the second I got to my college acting program, I was like, no, never mind. And how nuts is this? I actually thought that by admitting that I didn't want to be an actor anymore, that my parents would be disappointed. As you can imagine, they were thrilled. I was afraid that by changing my mind, I would look inconsistent. I would look hypocritical somehow. I would look chaotic. I would look unpredictable. I would look like someone that other people perceived as erratic and they wouldn't want to be involved with me anymore. LOL, my parents. Like, of course, they'll always want to be involved with me. But actually then, as it turned out, everyone in my life was like, oh, Amanda, we think you being a writer and actually more creative, I feel at the end of the day, and more related to language and you creating language, everyone was like, that makes so much more sense for you than being a theater actor. This plot point for you, it's better for the plot, actually. And so I really appreciated that. And I need to remember that story more often because I think it would probably help my decision making moving forward whenever I feel the sunk cost fallacy taking hold again.
I think we also really want to be like trustworthy. I can understand even if this isn't super conscious, maybe this is more subconscious that you're like the next thing I say I really want to do. I don't want people to look at that and be like, well, she said she wanted to do theater and she was wrong about that. We want to be trusted for the way that we feel and what we're saying. So I can understand how it's this subconscious thing of realizing, okay, if I'm wrong about this or change my mind about this, it will make my future decisions seem less trustworthy. And that would be devastating for us.
Very bad. Yeah. But then as it turns out, we don't always have accurate perceptions of our decision-making track record.
Right. And then it ends up being better than we thought. Going back into the relationship piece of this sunk cost fallacy, our audience is really interested in relationships. We have this segment called Ask the Every Girl, and the vast majority of questions are always about relationships. So I'm curious what you have learned from both your experience and the study of these concepts that you apply to your life now to ensure that you have the happiest love life and relationship possible.
Oh, I love that question. So this one extremely fun fact that I came across while writing that chapter that has served me extremely well, not only in my personal relationships and my romantic relationship, but also in my professional endeavors, is this notion of additive versus subtractive bias. So there was a study that I quoted in the book that highlighted how when human beings confront a problem, especially human beings living in consumerist society, where we're led to believe that anything can be solved by just adding something, a gadget, an apparatus, a supplement, whatever, in the natural human mind, when we encounter an issue or a challenge, we are naturally inclined to want to add something in order to fix the problem rather than take something away. Even when the subtractive solution or the solution involving taking something away would be simpler and more effective. So the study had to do with solving a spatial puzzle by adding or subtracting colored blocks. And the study's authors found that when presented with this challenge, the vast majority of people solved the puzzle by adding a whole bunch of colored blocks, when objectively this puzzle could have been much more easily solved by taking just one single block away. But most people didn't think of that. I now apply that to my life in so many arenas. I was struggling with my sleep. So I decided to buy a fancy new alarm clock, pillow spray, a bunch of supplements, just add everything but the kitchen sink to my sleep routine, when really all I needed to do was keep my iPhone out of the bedroom and stop drinking caffeine after 1 p.m. I just needed to take two blocks away. And that exact thing applies to relationships as well. Sometimes when you're experiencing challenges that feel insurmountable in a relationship, you think, you know what would help? Having a kid. You know what would help? Going on another vacation. You know what would help?
Getting married, getting engaged.
Yeah. Adding things to the picture, when sometimes the solution is merely taking something away, stepping back, scaling down, breaking up. And those subtractive solutions are sometimes painful, but they're not always that dramatic. It doesn't need to be like, you know, cut this person out of your life. I'm actually not in favor of jumping to cut people out of your life the second that they upset you. So there's a lot of nuance and personalization that needs to be applied to these scenarios. But that additive versus subtractive solution bias has really changed my life. I mean, down to like the ways that I deal with clutter in my home. I had a situation a year ago where I was like looking at my junk drawer. I was like, you know what would help with my junk drawer? If I just got some drawer organizers, adding something to the picture. No, you know what would help with your junk drawer? Throw it away. Understanding that that is a deep-seated trick that we play on our own minds has been life-changing.
Oh my God, I was literally just thinking of that example as you were talking. All the times that I've said, oh, I need to organize this, it's like I'll buy organization things rather than just saying, I need to get rid of some of this stuff. It's so true. It makes so much sense. I think that's such a great principle to apply to relationships. I'm thinking about, even if it's realizing we get in a lot of miscommunications over text rather than, I mean, I think everyone should be in therapy, but this is just an example of people being like, okay, now we got to go to therapy. Now we got to go on a vacation together. Now we got to add a date night and add all these things. Maybe the answer is just taking away no longer texting and you call each other instead of text. Like simple things like that. And I think it's so freeing to like simplify your life in that way in general. Not to brag, but I have the best mom ever. And she deserves so much more than a typical bouquet of roses and drugstore card that everyone else gets on Mother's Day. She deserves something personalized and thoughtful that makes her feel special. That is why I'm sending her a card from Moonpig. Moonpig has thousands of one-of-a-kind designs you can personalize with photos and personal messages, or opt for a large-size card for an extra special touch. Their cards are so cute, I am definitely going to be the favorite child this Mother's Day. Mom, plug your ears, but Moonpig is also incredibly affordable. It's the same price as a drugstore card. Postage is already included in the price, and it takes minimal effort. You don't need to leave your house to pick out a card or take it to the mailbox. Simply pick it out online, design, and place your order from the convenience and comfort of your own home. Whether you're celebrating a mom in your life or have upcoming birthdays, graduations, weddings, or other celebrations that call for an extra personalized touch for the people you love, get all your card needs from Moonpig. We have a special offer for you. Use code EVERYGIRLFREE for a free card from April 22nd until May 12th. That is EVERYGIRLFREE for a free card before May 12th. I want to dive into another cognitive bias from the book, The Halo Effect. Many of our listeners, like me, are huge Swifties. I know you use Taylor Swift as an example in the book. Can you explain how the way that we feel about celebrities like Taylor Swift can be a cognitive bias?
100%. So it's no secret that our parasocial relationships with celebrities are becoming more intense, more intimate, in scare quotes, if you could call it that. That chapter is called Are You My Mother, Taylor Swift? I couldn't help but notice the proliferation of familial or parental type language that people are using to describe their favorite celebrities, not just zaddy as a bit, but literally like mother. And yet at the same time, there are certain stans who in the same breath will say like Charlie XCX is on my mother list, but also all these songs are flops. So there are these like extreme cycles of celebrity worship and dethronement that we see in our society. And whether you're building up a celebrity as a mother god of sorts or canceling her, whatever that term might mean to you, it's both a form of dehumanization. And the way that the halo effect comes into play is that it's this age-old cognitive bias that we've always used to identify role models historically in our own communities. And it describes this penchant to think that because we like one quality in a person, say their music or their fashion sense, or just because they're famous, we might think that they are perfect overall, or we might make further assumptions about who they are. Just because we enjoy them and their art, they must also align with our values, that they must also be, I don't know, educated, worldly, care about the environment. And when they don't live up to those parasocial expectations, then we might feel the need to punish them, to treat them almost like a teenager would treat their mother when their mother disappoints them. We have the halo effect ostensibly. It is a part of who we are because during the days of ancient humans, we would find role models by jumping to conclusions about people based on very little data. So let's say there was someone in our tribe or community who had big muscles or intact teeth. Those things seem to suggest, oh, this person must be a skilled hunter, or this person is very capable in combat because they've avoided disfigurement. That seems like a great person for me to align myself with for survival. I'm going to jump to those conclusions because that's the most efficient use of my limited time and cognitive resources. But again, we are now applying these ancient cognitive biases to a different world, to the information age. We're not as much worried about survival from bear attacks anymore. Now we're worried about identity formation, community building. So we jump to conclusions that are just like much more cerebral and abstract when it comes to celebrities, the way that we jump to conclusions in a more concrete capacity when it came to people in our communities 20,000 years ago. And in this chapter, I sort of compare stories of pathologically obsessed stans and their gods, so to speak, the celebrities that they worship. I compare those stories to a story of my relationship to my own mother and how I almost was the crazed Swiftie to her Taylor Swift at certain points during my upbringing, because I really built her up in my mind as this perfect figure, even though she wasn't. She was a human being. And I really mistreated her sometimes because of that. I put her on this very narrow pedestal. And we tend to do that with our female role models, whether we know them in person or just worship them from afar, more than we do to male celebrities. You know, we have like narrower standards and a much higher pedestal for women in general. And there are studies to reflect that and why that is. I also found this sequence of extremely fascinating studies for the chapter that made correlations between our parasocial worshipful relationships of celebrities and our attachment styles to our own parents. So it was fascinating to find that, especially young people who lack so-called positive stressors from their parents in real life, their parental figures or their communities, tend to overfixate on virtual stressors, and the online aspect really heightens those illusory relationships and can be very unhealthy. And I think part of the reason why the Eras Tour meant so much to people was because it was a way to connect our face-to-face humanity, to reestablish that social glue that prevents those extremely tense relationships online from becoming too fanatical or too damaging for both celebrity and stan. So that's kind of my take on the whole thing. I'm really interested to see how Swifties will embrace that chapter. I had a Swiftie do an early read of my manuscript, which was very helpful. Not like I changed anything, but it was nice to know that that chapter had her approval. But it's important not to pander to the Swifties either.
Of course, we have to have a Swiftie proofread, of course. The celebrities in our culture, we cannot just like Taylor Swift's music. We can't just listen to her music and be like, this is good music. We want to keep listening to it because it's good for our enjoyment. We like need to know, how does she respond when this other celebrity is on stage and she gets an award and she doesn't respond the right way? And what's her dating life? And it's like, if someone does something that we don't like in their personal life, we can't like their work. We can't like their music. I think about like, what does that do for our mental health, that we cannot purely enjoy these things in our culture? We have to put all this meaning on them where it has to live up to impossible expectations. And it takes away our enjoyment. Like if Taylor Swift does something wrong tomorrow, so many people will be like, I can never listen to her music again. And that takes away whatever enjoyment you have.
Totally. First of all, we put more faith in celebrities now than we ever have, not just as entertainers, but as saviors of sorts. And that can be traced back to Reagan's presidency. He was perceived as this insurgent outsider. He was a celebrity himself who then became the president. That was right after a time in like the 60s and 70s when there was this incredible social unrest. We really started to lose trust in the government, the healthcare system, these institutions that had classically provided us with support. We didn't trust them as a society anymore. So who did we have to turn to as our new authority figure? Celebrities. And that sort of opened the floodgates for many decades of increased parasocial obsession. We look to Taylor Swift, not just for music, but for identity, for community, for her views on various social matters. We defend her as if she needs defending, as if we know her, as if we have laid some protective claim on her. So there's that historical context. There's also a story that I tell in the book related to my own mother about how when I took the time to understand and hear about the full 360 view of her humanity and all of the mistakes that she had made in her early life and things like that, it didn't ruin my perception of her. It didn't ruin my relationship with her. It humanized her so that I could see her in more dimensions. The sort of metaphor behind the halo effect is the crown of light that you might see above an angel's head in a Renaissance painting, let's say. You can't see anything else when that halo is above the person because it's putting a spotlight on them. But when you take away that halo, it illuminates the other elements in the picture. So you can perceive a person in the context of their life, in the context of the rest of the world. And that generates more empathy because we're like, oh, they're not just this single godlike figure on a pedestal. They're a person. And yet I understand why people have high expectations of someone like Taylor Swift, because she has gained so much power in society. And it is proven by not only Ronald Reagan, but so many other very politically involved celebrities like Dolly Parton, that celebrities can have immense political and social power when they choose to get involved with those things. But then it poses the question of, should they swerve out of their lane to have that influence? Do we expect them to swerve in our direction? If they don't swerve in our direction, does that affect how we perceive their music? Is it really appropriate for us to be looking to celebrities for what we believe socially and politically or even religiously? If we're not looking to celebrities, who are we supposed to look to? These are all questions that I don't necessarily provide definitive answers to, but that I certainly reckon with in that chapter.
Yeah, there's so many layers to it. I also think it's so interesting how you apply this to your mother. I can imagine that this happens to a lot of people and their mothers. I feel like it is this really interesting experience where dads in general get brownie points for showing up, and that we look at our fathers as like, oh, they were the best and amazing and couldn't do any wrong because they were there and they were kind and they were good. And then we look at our mothers and are like, yeah, they were there, they were kind, they were good, but they didn't do this perfectly. They didn't do this perfectly. And we can have this halo effect come crashing down when we become an adult or we get older and we realize, oh, they're not perfect, as no one is. It's like the halo effect has burst. And that's where a lot of this resentment comes from. So I loved your example because you talk about, like you just said, when you got to learn all these things about your mother and the halo effect shattered, but you got to learn her as this complex individual. I would imagine that that would deepen a relationship rather than strain it.
100%. And to be clear, like, perceiving my dad's humanity in four dimensions as I've gotten older has also significantly improved my relationship with him. The difference is that he never had that halo to me. I never sort of had that expectation of perfection from him the way that I did for my mother.
Is there a reason that this happens more often on women than men? Is that like the innate thing, or is it more of a cultural newer phenomenon from like patriarchal culture?
I would wager to guess it's a little bit more patriarchal. The margin for error for literally anyone who might hold a minoritized identity in this culture is very, very slim comparatively. It's exactly what you said. If our dad screws up, we give him so much leeway in comparison. If our mom screws up, we give her comparatively little. I was pointed to this very interesting theory that had been pointed out by a British psychologist named Don Winnicott, the concept of the good enough mother. He argued that when it comes to like our actual mothers, in theory, if there were such a thing as a perfect mother, the theoretical child would come out overly sensitive, fragile, incapable of dealing with the disappointments of life. all we really need is a good enough mother who loves us good enough, who supports us good enough, who provides for our survival needs for sure. The rest of it kind of just has to be good for us to come out okay. And I think that same lens can be applied to celebrities. We just need our celebrity mothers to be good enough.
I think that it will make us more empathetic, like you said. But I think then it also allows us all the freedom. Like, imagine if celebrities did not have this halo effect on them. If they had freedom to be more expressive and more true to themselves, if we didn't put all this pressure on our mothers and we got to just love them and understand them and appreciate them being good enough rather than where they failed and weren't perfect, imagine how much deeper our experience as humans could be.
I think it might improve our resilience. It certainly improved mine to become more aware of these ideas.
The last topic here that I want to talk to you about, I want to share with our audience a study that you cite in the book that I underlined this like a billion times. It was so interesting to me. So this is about what you call the shit-talking hypothesis. So you share a 2022 study that found that by elementary school, girls have already learned to compare themselves only to the peers they perceive as superior to them. So they're thinking, I'm not as popular as that girl. I'm not as pretty as that girl. I'm not as smart as that girl. But by contrast, men, of course, are more likely to notice only their less attractive peer. So while we are clocking for threats, men are like, I'm doing pretty good. So this to me was fascinating. Why do you think that women and girls are so wired for comparison?
Yeah, this study too, it also blew my mind. It suggested that women make more upward comparisons and downward identifications. So when you walk into a party and you survey the room as a girl or a woman, or when you even scroll through your feed, you're only going to clock the perceived threats, the people who you think are superior to you. And part of the reason, I think, is because the patriarchy sets up a zero-sum game for women. We grow up understanding that there are only so many spots in C-suites for women. There are only so many spots on the Supreme Court. There are only so many spots in society's favor for women to succeed and to be perceived in a flattering light. So growing up with that notion, we come to perceive other women as threats to us. We come to perceive life as a zero-sum game, even though life in general is not like a pizza pie. You get a slice, I lose a slice. But I think it's really, yeah, it's this game that the patriarchy has devised to keep us in comparison purgatory.
It is crazy in how much we see it affecting our self-esteem. And then, of course, we're feeling like we're never good enough because all we're seeing is what we deem as more superior. Do you have advice about what we can do about it, or what has helped you once you realized you were in the zero-sum bias place?
Yes. Oh my gosh. In the chapter, I quote this iconic piece that was published in 2013 in The Cut by Anne Friedman and Aminat Tussaud that talked about shine theory. Shine theory is this idea that you can combine your light with women that you perceive as confident, attractive, intelligent, wealthy, any value that you might hold. It's not a zero-sum game where their light means your darkness. There's potentially limitless light in abstract terms in the universe. And so I really started to apply that practically to the way that I engage with people in my category, because the other thing is ironically, and like much to our misery, we tend to compare ourselves the worst to people who remind us of ourselves. That's the pattern for women and probably for men too. So when I see a woman who reminds me of myself in a way that could potentially produce a close friendship, my immediate instinct is, oh my God, I have to beat her. That person is threatening my light. That person is threatening my success, when there's actually no evidence that's true. So to combat that, when I'm online and I come across, say, another brunette, bobbed, girly who loves pastel blazers who publishes nonfiction.
What did my immediate call across a lot of them?
No, thank God. Thank God for my mental health. But increasingly, like, I'm getting older. Yeah, these are publishing. Like, go then, you know. So when I come across someone like that, my impulse, I'm ashamed to admit, might at first be like, oh my God, where did this person go to school? Have they made the New York Times bestseller list? Are they better than me? And that might live rent free in my head and make me feel bad about myself. Then I remember this is zero sum bias. I can use shine theory to combine our light. And so then instead, what I often do is like slide into their DMs, express a sincere expression of admiration for what they've done. If they live in LA or in New York and I happen to be in town, I'll be like, let's get coffee. Odds are they might feel the same way about me. And I swear to you, this is like not self-helpy bullshit. I have made more than one close friendship by applying this new tactic. Before it was torturing me. Before I would come across these people and be like, oh my God, I can't have this person exist in the world. And even if they don't become a close friend, like sometimes I'll ask if they would want to collaborate on a project. Could I interview you for my podcast? There is absolutely a way to combine light. Don't let the patriarchy think that this zero-sum game is natural and innate and normal. We can fight against it.
I literally wrote when I read it out of the Shine Theory in the book, I literally wrote by it, this is the Every Girl brand. This is our mission, is we're combining our lights to shine brighter rather than having this. There's only one person that's going to get this partner, going to get this job. I think this is one of these things that is so universal that we experience looking at other people as, okay, there's one other woman or one other person who's like me in my company. So they're my competition. Yeah. They're who I need to be better than. They're who I need to beat. If they're doing well, I can't do well.
Because again, in a much, much earlier era of human history, that person probably would have been your direct competition for mates, resources, what have you. But that's just not the case anymore.
Yeah. Look at what we can be doing. Like your example of now, instead of having it torture you and being like, I hate this girl so much. You are reaching out to her, becoming a friend, or shining your light together and doing something that's beneficial for both of you. We are brighter when we are together.
The amazing example that this Shine Theory piece in The Cut by Anna Naminasu made was if Kelly Rowland knows that she shines brighter because of her proximity to Beyonce rather than appearing more dim, then there's hope for the rest of us. They articulated it much better than that, but I love that notion because who shines brighter than Beyonce? You'd think like she would totally steal Kelly Rowland's thunder, but no, Kelly burns brighter because of Beyonce.
Yes, it's so true. And I think that also there's this cliche that I hate so much, that women are like jealous and catty and that envy is the default of being a woman. And I think hate this so much, but this is such a great counter to it, to be like, no, actually, this was something put on our brains to be wired to do, thanks in part to the patriarchy, but we actually are better when we are together. I mean, you see this all the time. This is the stupidest example, but The Bachelor is top of mind for me. Everyone is like competing for the man during The Bachelor. And then you see once you become friends and they go on Bachelor in Paradise and you're like, oh, I like you way more than I liked you when you were individual competing with other women.
Right. It's the
stupidest possible example of the shine
theory. I like that. I like that though, because what's more of a contrived patriarchal zero sum game than The Bachelor?
Right.
I watch it literally. Too. I watch it too.
I mean, how do you not? But you can witness it by being like, they are brighter together. Reading through this chapter really made me think every time I see someone who I want to be like, I will make an effort to befriend them, not to get in my head about where I'm falling compared to them, why I don't like them, trying to poke holes in what they're doing. I want to befriend them. If I want to be like them, I'll befriend them.
And look, even if that person doesn't want to be your friend for some reason, their bandwidth, who knows, something going on in their life, or they don't check their DM requests, who knows, then it still feels so good to put that energy of camaraderie and solidarity out there, because not in any kind of new agey manifesty type way. It's more for your own attitude, for your own self-perception. It doesn't feel good to move through the world clocking threats that aren't actually threats. It feels much better to move through the world clocking potential for connection.
Yeah, it's turning something that feels like such a lack, like a limiting thing, knowing that there's someone else like you that's maybe doing better than you because you've decided that. And instead, it's look at what's possible. Look at these opportunities. Look at the amazing people that are out there that are like me. And that's a good thing that I can connect with. The energy of how you get to go through life when you have this idea instead of being bogged down by the threat.
I think in like everyday conversation, people often refer to this concept as abundance versus scarcity mindset. But as it turns out, like, this zero-sum bias is a real behavioral economics concept. And I find that having the empirical studies to back those sort of conventional wisdoms is so helpful to a nerd like me.
Oh my gosh, Amanda, I could talk to you forever. Sadly, I can't. We're going to wrap up with some rapid-fire questions. First question for you. A topic or pop culture news that has you in a chokehold right now?
I mean, I feel like, well, sorry, I'm so bad at rapid fire. whatever's happening in pop culture that makes its way into my Sounds Like a Cult podcast tends to have me in a chokehold for a week at a time. We just released an episode that touched on Gypsy Rose Blanchard. So I would say probably Gypsy Rose Blanchard.
Okay, I'm excited to listen to that. Best piece of advice that you've ever received?
Oh my God.
I know. These are hard. I'm so sorry.
Go to therapy.
Go to therapy and get advice from your therapist is the best advice we could give.
Yeah, go to therapy. I can much more easily think of the worst advice I've ever received.
Tell us the worst.
Oh my God. When I moved to LA, I was very insecure about not living in like the literary capital of the United States. I was like, how am I supposed to create a bookish career here? And I would attend so many literary events and literary conferences that would roll through town. And I remember I attended this one literary conference when I was like 22, where this woman was like, you cannot have a writing day job and also pursue a career writing books. You need to like be independently wealthy or just temp or have a writing unrelated day job. I was like, what? And that's so wrong. It is true that a lot of people who write books are independently wealthy. That is not me. But having a day job in digital media, writing every single day, completely prepared my muscles, so to speak, for writing a book.
I'm so glad that you did not listen to that advice. Last question for you, Amanda. Speaking of books, what is a book that changed your life, obviously besides your own?
I am a huge fan of Mary Roach. She's a science writer. Her writing is very funny. She's written a number of New York Times bestsellers. My favorite of hers is a book called Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. And it is like this hilarious, tantalizing, thought-provoking exploration of the world of dead bodies. And I derive a lot of inspiration from her writing about sciencey topics with a humorous tone. And I am so hashtag blessed that she actually blurbed The Age of Magical Overthinking. She endorsed it. I've loved her since I was very, very young, like just coming to terms with the fact that I wanted to publish books for a living. So that was totally a thrill.
You are like so cool that you have the most like niche, cool interests.
Appreciate you saying that.
Where can everyone find you? Podcasts, books, I know you got a lot going on. So let us know where we can find you.
The Age of Magical Overthinking is available wherever books are sold on April 9th, hardbook, ebook, audiobook. I also have a podcast called Sounds Like a Cult about the modern day cults we all follow, from Disney adults to Instagram therapists, which drops every Tuesday. I'm launching a new podcast in conjunction with the new book called Magical Overthinkers. That's coming out May 15th.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. And then I'm also on Substack at amandamontel.substack.com. I'm reluctantly on Instagram at Amanda _Montel and all the usual suspect places.
Amanda, thank you so much. This was so beyond fascinating. Everybody go check out the book. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. I know I sure did. Please do not forget to rate, review, and subscribe. It really makes a huge difference for our show so we can keep growing and bringing the content that you love. If you want more info, you can find us at The Evergirl Podcast on Instagram or theevergirlpodcast.com. Talk to you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.